Oh, this morning I was getting ready to come to church. This has nothing to do with the sermon, but this is something that Belinda said to me. I had said I wasn't going to get a haircut until I got that second shot, which is a couple of days after Easter. But Belinda was standing behind me, and she said, your hair's so long, you remind me of someone famous. And I said, oh, really? Who's that? And she said, I'm not really sure. So it's either Wild Bill Hickok or Doris Day's stunt double. Yeah, I make a home and cut it myself after that one. Gonna let you all guess who I'm talking about here, and then I'll let you know in a moment. Father Bill will get this right off the bat. The clue being bat. No. This man played 19 years in the major leagues. He was a three-time MVP winner. He played in 75 World Series games. And in 71 of those 75, he got at least one hit. And when he stopped being a great player, he became a manager and coach. And as a manager, he took both the Yankees and the Mets to the World Series. But despite all these accomplishments, people don't remember him for his glory days in baseball or the great things that he did. When they hear his name, they think of something else. When you hear the name Yogi Berra, most people don't even think of baseball. They think of his witticisms, those humorous, memorable quotes that he would do that have now become known as Yogiisms. And I'll give you a couple of them. You can observe a lot by just watching. And probably the most famous, it ain't over till it's over. But this one's my favorite. When you come to the fork in the road, take it. Now that little bit of wisdom I want us to hang on to today, because, you know, a lot of times in our journey that we call life, we come to those forks in the road and you're forced to make a decision. Now, most decisions are relatively small. They have very little impact on the overall scheme of our lives. But some of the decisions we make are momentous and have tremendous impact on our lives. These are called the turning points of life. Where will I go to school? What profession will I pursue? Do I want to do this or this? I remember in college, I must have hit that fork like five or six times and taken a different path every time. Or is this the person I'm to marry? Is this the person I'm going to raise a family with? We're forced into these turning point kinds of choices constantly. And our gospel lesson this morning tells us about a turning point in Jesus' ministry. In fact, this entire gospel lesson is itself the turning point in the Gospel of John. John is obviously very different from the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And talk about this here for just a moment. That in the gospel according to John, scholars generally divide it into two major parts. I mean, there is a prologue and there is an epilogue. That prologue, which we all love in John 1, in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God. And the epilogue, which comes in the 21st, at the end of the 21st chapter. But the book itself, chapters 2 through 11, generally is called the Book of Signs. And the signs are those seven miracles that Jesus performs in the Gospel of John. And they're very, very powerful in that in each of these signs, it launches into an important teaching of Jesus. So when he raises Lazarus from the dead, which is the seventh miracle, when he raises him from the dead there in chapter 11, it leads into the teaching, I am the resurrection and the life. But all of these are in that one book, the Book of Signs, and that's chapters 2 through 11. And then chapter 13 through 21, that's called the Book of Glory. Say, well, what happened to chapter 12? Chapter 12, where we are today, the first part of it goes with the Book of Signs. The second part of it goes with the Book of Glory. But this lesson that we have today is right square in the middle. And it is the turning point from the Book of Signs to the Book of Glory. And the Book of Glory, they're the familiar things that you're aware of. Jesus' farewell discourse, the trial of Jesus, his crucifixion and resurrection, and the resurrection appearance with the disciples in Galilee. But this turning point is our gospel text today. It's the coming of the Greeks, or as I jokingly said to Father Chris before the service, the coming of the geeks. The coming of the Greeks to the Feast of the Passover, and they want to see Jesus. In the King James, it's, sir, we would see Jesus, and that's written right here in front of me on this pulpit. And written on just about every pulpit I've ever been in some fashion. Sir, we would see Jesus, reminding the preacher what our task is, to show you Jesus. But in this Passover festival, when they come to see Jesus, this is a turning point in the gospel. Now, in the gospel of John, if you can read something with two different meanings, which one of them is true? Both. Yeah. Is that one? Which one is it? You're right. It's that one. They wish to see Jesus. Well, in the Gospel of John, to see something means more than just to do it with your optical nerve going back into your brain and it registers. They didn't just want to see Jesus and walk up and, hey, we saw him. Let's go. It carries with it that sense of understanding and knowing. And actually in the Gospel of John, it often means to believe. If you remember in one of the signs, when Jesus healed the man who was blind from birth, that's almost the entire ninth chapter of the Gospel of John that goes on and on and on. It's a fabulous story as it unfolds. And in the end, it ends with the dispute with the Pharisees. And Jesus says to them, for judgment I have come into this world so that the blind will see and that those who see will become blind. It's about spiritual sight. And these Greeks are Gentiles. They're proselytes who love the teachings of Judaism and want to know more about it. And they're in town and they've heard about Jesus. Most likely they heard about the resurrection of Lazarus. They want to see him. And so he come. Philip and Andrew bring them to Jesus. And we don't hear anything else about him. It's kind of like poor Nicodemus comes to Jesus in the third chapter of John, and they have a conversation, and Jesus answers him, and you never see Nicodemus again. It launches into a teaching. The same with these Greeks who come. Because when Jesus sees them, this is what he says. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And we had already been told, if you're reading the Gospel of John, you've been told three times up to this point that it is not the hour. At the wedding feast in Cana, Jesus says to his mother, my hour has not yet come. In the seventh chapter in Jerusalem, they're seeking Jesus to arrest him. They sought therefore to take him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. In the eighth chapter in the temple, after the incident with the woman caught in adultery, in the temple, they're seeking to arrest him, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. And now the hour has come. And we're told that in this hour, the Son of Man will be glorified. And can you imagine what the Greeks were thinking? They must have thought, wow, we got here just in time. We were wanting to see Jesus, and we got here in time to see him be glorified. Wow. But the Greeks, as well as Jesus' disciples and others standing around that day, were no doubt thinking of what they understood glory to be in human terms. Human glory does not come into play in this at all. In fact, human glory is so different from the glory that Jesus is talking about that they're really, they're opposites. It's counterintuitive. And the Apostle Paul, when he talks about the cross, makes it clear how counterintuitive it is when he wrote to the Corinthians 1:22, Jews demand a sign and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. The Son of Man will be glorified in this hour by the cross. The greatest moment of Jesus' glory in the Gospel of John is the cross. And Jesus says, when I'm lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. It's interesting to note that in John's gospel, unlike in the synoptics, they don't strip Jesus before they crucify him. He goes to the cross wearing a robe and a crown. Now, from a human perspective, the crucifixion had to be seen as a disaster, an absolute disaster, and an end to the ministry of Jesus, and a victory for all of his enemies and those who opposed him. I'm sure that's what the high priests were thinking that day, and the scribes and the Pharisees. They had won a victory. Can you imagine how the crucifixion looked to Satan? Yahoo! It had to look like the ultimate victory. But Jesus makes it clear in this passage that it's the exact opposite. It's counterintuitive even to demonic and diabolical reasoning. Jesus said, now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. And I thought of this when you were showing us the icons a couple of weeks ago, that if there was one facial expression that God would allow me to see in history, just one facial expression, the one I would pick is, I would love to see Satan's face when Jesus showed up in hell. and his expression when he led the people out. Wow. But I'm sorry, I'm getting way ahead of where we are. Let's go back to the fork in the road. This is a turning point in Jesus' ministry because at this moment, Jesus has to make a decision. Now, in the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this decision is made in the Garden of Gethsemane. And we all know that story so well, and we'll relive it this Thursday in our vigil. In Matthew, it says, going on a little further, he threw himself on the ground and he prayed, Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not my will, but your will be done. In John's gospel, Jesus goes to the garden to pray, but we're not told any of the words of the prayer. We're not told about any agony that Jesus is suffering at all. John places those words of Jesus in this passage of scripture, with the realization of the arrival of the hour. Jesus says, now my soul is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it was for this very reason that I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. It's the same sentiment in prayer that's there in the Synoptic Gospels in the garden. And as with that Gethsemane prayer, Jesus chooses the path that he will follow. It's the path of that divine paradox, that he chooses life for the world through his death. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life because of this hour, this cross. He says, very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the earth and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Jesus chooses the path that leads to death in order to bring life. Jesus chooses the path that leads to death to glorify God. He chooses the path that leads to death to defeat Satan. He chooses the path that leads to death to draw all people to himself. And here's the kicker. Jesus chooses the path that leads to death, and he invites us to follow him. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me. And where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. Did you hear the powerful part of that phrase? Whoever serves me must follow me. So today, as we hear these words of Jesus, you and I have arrived at a fork in the road. And we are invited into that divine paradox. And if you love your life too much to choose that path, you will lose it. But if you're willing to lay down your life in service to Christ, you will gain it. Now, it's a little jarring to hear such extremes when you're making a choice. Love your life, hate your life. Pick one. In Semitic language, extremes are generally used when you're trying to get people to make a decision. We don't do that so much in our culture or when we speak English, when we want people to make a choice, unless you're running for political office. Then you use extremes. If you're a Republican, you never, ever run against a Democrat. You run against a leftist, socialist, communist. And if you're a Democrat, you never run against a Republican. You run against a conservative, heartless fascist. You choose, they want you to choose between something horrible and something as wonderful as they are. Polar opposites have a way to force us to make decisions. But with Jesus, we are called to follow by surrendering our lives to his life, our wills to his will, and to follow him in a life of service. No doubt many of you know who Dietrich Bonhoeffer was. He was a theologian and a professor, and he had the opportunity to leave Germany during World War II. His friends wanted him to leave and go to the States, but he stayed in Germany and worked with the underground church. And he was implicated in a plot to kill Hitler and was executed. But in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, people always quote this one line. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. And that really fits here. When Christ calls us, he bids us to come and die with him. And as powerful as that quote is, I wanted to back up in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, and read you the paragraph in which this sits. The cross is laid on every Christian. The first Christ suffering, which every man must experience, is the call to abandon the attachments of this world. It's the dying of the old man, which is the result of the encounter with Christ. As we embark upon discipleship, we surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death. We give over our lives to death. Thus it begins. The cross is not the terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. When we get to the forks in the road, sometimes it's really, really difficult to make a decision. Which way will I go with my life? I want to share a story with you. Belinda's father, George, was a Moravian pastor. And, he shared a story with me once years ago talking about children's sermons and how they can turn on you. If you've ever done a children's sermon, you know, you should probably get combat pay for doing them. Because kids can really trip you up. And so he had a simple thing for the children to make a decision, a choice. In one hand, he had candy. In the other hand, he had an old rusty nail. And he asked the kids, which one of these would you choose? And of course, they all said they would choose a candy. That is, except for one whose name, Stephen. Stephen said, I would choose the nail. And he said, oh, no. And so he says, oh, really? If you had the choice, Stephen, between the candy and the nail, which one would you take? I'd take the nail. Stephen, why would you take the nail? Because I'm diabetic and I can't have the candy anyway. I'll take the rusty nail. We're called to choose the rusty nail. Not the sweet life that the world offers, which really isn't that sweet. We're called to take the rusty nail. So today we come to the fork in the road and take it from a good Catholic boy, Yogi Berra, take it. Amen.